Your dreams, ambitions, and priorities are what make you unique. With Associated Bank Private Wealth, we've got you. Our personalized approach to wealth planning puts your goals at the center of your plan. Visit associatedbank.com/privatewealth. Member FDIC.
We're on with David Fowler this morning from Associated Bank. It's our thought leader conversation. David, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Doing very well, staying healthy, and I hope you are as well and everybody at Associated Bank. I want to begin this morning with you reminding people what you do at Associated.
I work on the capital markets side of the bank, where we help our clients basically managing financial risk through the use of foreign exchange products, interest rate products, and energy products.
Well, front and center this morning, I want to begin with some financials from the UK on the international markets. So we see sterling stuck near an eight-week low and negative interest rates in the UK, possibly, likely.
Yeah, very likely. Certainly, sterling is looking both from a fundamental point of view and also from the, you know, chartists that watch this from a technical point of view. A lot of people are still looking for a major move lower in sterling over the next 6 months. Some people talking about a move down towards 103 or 104 against the dollar. So levels we haven't seen for 30 years.
Yeah, and this idea of negative interest rates as well. I know the U.S. has not seen any of that yet. Some other places in the world has, but the U.K. could possibly be going there.
Yeah, the thing about negative interest rates that people need to think about is that governments will only do this as a very much a last resort, because it is very much a double-edged sword. The idea that, you know, if we make it as cheap as possible for people to borrow funds, then this will stimulate the economy, is kind of one side of that equation. And that's the reason why governments tend to look at this as a tool in their armory. The other side, though, is that negative interest rates imply that everything will be cheaper tomorrow than it'll be today, which is the whole basis of deflation. And from an economic point of view, economists have a number of tools to deal with inflation, so prices going up. They have very few tools to deal with prices going down. And, you know, the classic example is what happened to Japan in the early 90s, where in order to re-stimulate the economy, they created vast amount of money supply. Interest rates were at zero or below. And they hoped that this would be something that would reflate the economy. You know, 25, 30 years later, they're still hoping. Again, you know, it's either if it works, it's great. If it doesn't work, it can be very difficult to get out of, and you can end up in this kind of deflationary spiral, which absolutely no country wants to get into.
David, how much of what we're seeing here is tied to the COVID-19 pandemic, and how much is it tied to Brexit?
Well, in the UK, it is the, you know, perfect storm, to use that analogy, I suppose. It's both. You know, what we've seen recently is that, obviously, the COVID-19 issues are front and center because it's, you know, the hottest fire, and it's something that impacts on everybody, and it's obviously very visible and, you know, has led to, you know, sickness and sadly death. Brexit has taken a second place to that, and probably rightly so. But we also have a deadline coming up in June where both parties, both the European Union and the UK, have to attest that they see a path forward to negotiation. If they don't, then really both sides go back to their corners and start preparing for what effectively would be WTO rules from January 1st of 2021. So the issue that they have right now is that the UK has kind of taken quite a while to produce what they actually want. They've been quite vocal about what they don't want in terms of the proposal from the European Union. Only this week we've seen what they actually would like, and it reflects the fundamental difference between the two negotiating parties. You know, the UK wants to have a trade deal, and that's all. And the European Union is afraid that if they have a large competitor very close by that operates on completely different labor standards, quality standards, and, you know, a number of other standards, that it will provide unfair competition into their market. And this is something that has been there from the very beginning. It's the whole basis of, you know, frankly, why the UK wanted to leave. They really wanted to be part of a trade organization. They didn't want to be part of a political organization. And the European Union looks on, you know, greater harmonization across Europe as being the way forward for a stronger European Union collectively. And that's the real problem. You have two sets of people with very different desired outcomes trying to negotiate a deal where now time is becoming a constraint. Because, as you know, the UK has said that they will not look for an extension, nor will they agree to an extension past December 31st of this year.
And there's certainly an argument for how this might be an unfair process. I know I saw this story about how the EU wanted access to UK fishing grounds but wanted to restrict British access to some of its markets. It feels like there's an unfairness there.
I think it's felt as though, certainly from the European Union side, there is a feeling that the UK is negotiating in bad faith. And they felt this for a while. They felt this when Prime Minister May was in power. You know, they would have a deal, and then suddenly they wouldn't have a deal. In fact, even the withdrawal agreement that was signed by Boris Johnson last year was the deal that Theresa May brought up originally 2.5 years previously at a Council of Ministers meeting, that she then said, you know, this is our deal. This is what we will do. We will, you know, this is how we will make sure that Northern Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement can remain intact as we leave. And, you know, a week later, she said, no, I can't do that anymore. And yet, then 2.5 years later, Boris Johnson signs on to exactly the same deal. So there is a feeling that from the EU side, they're not negotiating with a real kind of trusted partner anymore. And from the UK side, you know, they feel that, you know, the whole basis of Brexit was this idea of sovereignty. And they feel that the EU is trying to take their ability to create their own laws, their own regulations, their own rules, their own way in the world away from them. So there is a feeling of kind of bad faith from both sides.
One area of concern has been immigration. The Brexit may limit the movement around the European Union from the European Union to the UK. And I know the UK is more concerned now with coronavirus about having enough people, enough professionals and experts in its National Health Service. Talk to us a little bit about how those discussions are going.
Well, this week, the UK will be bringing in its new immigration policy, which is a points-based system based somewhat on the kind of Australian system. The way it works pretty simply is that for every skill you have, you get a certain amount of points. If those skills are in demand in the UK, you'll get bonus points for those. And, you know, at the end of the day, they tot up the points. And if you meet the target, you can come to the UK. And if you don't, you can't, which is completely different from what we've had in the European Union, where just as in the United States, if you live in Chicago and you want to move to California, you know, you get in your car and you go. You can work in California. There's no restrictions. There's no one to stop you. In the European Union, I can live anywhere in the European Union. I can work anywhere in the European Union without restriction. And I have to be treated in the same way as any other EU national. What we had in the past is, traditionally, there was a lot of immigration from Southeastern Europe, from the EU members and that part of the world, and also in Central Europe, migrated, you know, to Germany, to France, and also to Britain. And because of wage differentials, often people who were quite skilled in their own country, like if we take Romania or something, you know, they could take an entry-level job in the UK or Germany and still make more money. So it was quite an attractive proposition. For people with lower skills, it was even more attractive. So you saw that a lot of the people who worked in nursing homes as maybe cleaners in hospitals or porters came from places like Romania, where they could, you know, they filled that gap because there was a shortage of people to do that work. The other area, of course, that you would see this would be in agricultural workers. And as you may have seen, Prince Charles sent out a video this week looking for people who are going to be sticker pickers. So people, too, who would stick with picking fruits and vegetables because they're afraid that there's going to be a shortage of agricultural workers this year because of the changes in immigration.
So talk to us a little bit about, you know, the end result there. I know there was one, at least one study that suggested that some of those high-level professionals that would be important to, again, let's say the National Health Service there, you may be harder to attract some of those people with the new rules.
Well, there will be, because some of the people that are already filling those jobs are European EU nationals who will have to leave or get residency. I think there's also a feeling that, you know, for the high end, you know, people with high skills, as long as their skills are in demand, they will still be able to come to the UK. And they may not want to come to the UK. And because of this, because of leaving the European Union, where you're also going to see this, though, is a cascading effect. So hospitals, as we've seen, even in the United States, you know, the demand for nurses, the demand for people, not only for doctors, for all the other ancillary people, is so great because people, I think, have a new understanding that, you know, it takes a lot of people to run a hospital. And, you know, for areas like social work, particularly in nursing homes and in, you know, visitation. So in the UK, it's very common for elderly individuals who live on their own to have somebody who is paid by the state to come visit them every day and maybe do their laundry or make their meals and things like this. These kind of areas, people are really worried that there just will be no one to do this work. So it kind of impacts everything from the very top, where you may have people who feel that they cannot get permanent residence in the UK, as EU nationals, cascading all the way down. And right now, the last thing the UK needs is a greater shortage of staff in the national health system.
David, here in the United States, all 50 states now have reopened to some extent of after their COVID-19 lockdowns internationally. I know we're seeing some improvement as well. If you had to offer advice to investors, international investors, about where their play should be right now, are we still hedging or are we still in a defensive mode? What would be the posture?
I think from a foreign exchange point of view, in a broader sense, I think it's just too early to see what's going to happen. So I think a cautious approach is still very warranted. I do think that there's a potential in the longer term for interest rates to go substantially higher. And I would certainly suggest to people who, you know, for corporations particularly, or even for, you know, individuals who have maybe a floating rate mortgage, to maybe look to lock in some fixed rate funds. That these are fantastic levels. And certainly, I think that prudence across all aspects of managing that type of risk is important. The situation is still, I think, very uncertain. And to do anything too kind of bold or brave at this time may not be the best approach.
David, how can people get a hold of you and have a one-on-one if they want?
You know, you can always call us at the trading room. Our phone number is 866-524-8836. Or you can email me at david.feller, that's david.feller, at associatedbank.com.
It's always great chatting with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Steve.